If it please the court, I'm Thomas Wexler, the attorney for Guardian and Conservator Services, who I will frequently refer to as GCS in my presentation. This case is unique in many ways, not the least of which is the tremendous volume of emails that were substantially generated by Ms. Earle. We're not talking about even hundreds of pages of emails. We're talking about thousands. And it may have been my fault for not offering the emails themselves into evidence at the first fee hearing, but my sense was that that was an undue burden on the court that wasn't necessary because we offered exhibits 19 and 23. And I invite the court to look carefully at exhibits 19 and 23, which exhibit 19 is 38 pages single-spaced. Exhibit 23 is a more summary type of presentation of the tremendous volume of work that my client was performing.
Was there any place in the record where you offered additional evidence concerning all of that documentation that the district court declined to receive it?
There are places in the transcript where my client was testifying about various major items in the billings and where the court intervened and said, Mr. Wexler, can't we abbreviate this and make it go more quickly?
Right, which still leaves my question. Was there any point in the hearing where you said, here's another exhibit that contains all of those pages of emails and offered as an exhibit, and it was declined?
There was. Ms. Earle, in addition to her tremendous emailing, also emailed to me. And she sent me, over a three-month period, about 165 pages of emails. I offered those. She admitted that she sent them. I offered those into evidence, and the court excluded them, saying they're cumulative.
So is the district court making a determination about the reasonableness of the 0.1 per email policy, or is it your view that the district court is erring in its reluctance to make this email by email by email determination in the absence of that policy?
If I understand your question correctly, it seems to me the court is deciding that the contractual provision for what is the exact language? For 6-minute increments does not mean a minimum of 6 minutes.
Right. So again, I think there's two ways to view it. The district court could be saying that that policy of charging 0.1 per email is an unreasonable policy. On the other hand, the district court did, at least in part, go through email by email by email to determine, in the absence of that policy, how much time would it reasonably take for someone to read and respond. So my question is, do you think that the district court should have done that for every email and didn't? Or are you saying that it was error for the district court to look at this 1.1 policy per email and say that that blanket rule is unreasonable? Which is the error that you're saying the district court committed? Because if it's the policy side, then I don't know that we need to address the invitation to present summary evidence at all and whether that creates a problem.
We have competing standards here. We have what I would call the ordinary contract standard, which I think would be uniformly enforced because 0.1 is a common provision in contracts of this kind. I'm not talking about guardianship contracts necessarily. More commonly, we see it in attorney's fee contracts.
And when you say that, are you saying that you think it's a common policy for lawyers to charge as a policy 0.1 per email?
I think it's not uncommon for lawyers to have a minimum charge per contact. 0.1 would be the least you'd probably ever see, but I've seen many that are.
Obviously, the problem with that, though, is that it allows for unethical billing, whether it's a services or a lawyer. If you spent less than the full 0.6, let's say it took you 0.1, and you did that successive times, you could potentially double, triple, quadruple count that same six-minute increment.
So I've provided you with the American Bar Association.
From 1993.
Yes.
And I think that there have been some changes since then in terms of the ethics around rounding up. And even if you look at the opinion that you did provide, which may not be useful for our decision-making here, because, again, we're looking at what the error is that the district court committed, not pronouncing some ethic rule. But even if you look at that opinion, I think there are some things from that opinion from the ABA that would suggest you shouldn't have a policy of 0.1 or 0.25 per contact or per email. So the question, again, for me is, are you saying it was error for the court to, or you think, do you think the district court found that that policy was unreasonable, or do you think that it was error for the district court not to have gone email by email by email, all 7,000 of them or however many there were, and decide in the absence of such a policy how much time would it reasonably take somebody to respond and read that email?
I think the court, first of all, was deciding that the policy itself is invalid because they were rejecting the my client's contention that we follow the contract and the contract says we do this. We informed her at the start that we do this, so she was aware of it. And I need to call to your attention, I hope this didn't escape you, that the very first significant invoice, the March invoice, my client, before there was any dispute about whether or not she was going to get paid, was no charging large numbers of the emails. My client was not seeking to soak anybody. There were, I think, 412 emails my client no charged. About 112 of those, my numbers might be off a little bit, but it was 29% of them. My client no charged right at the start. The court didn't ask them to. Ms. Earle didn't ask my client to. My client just did that because that seemed to be the appropriate, reasonable thing to do. And my client continued to do that throughout this relationship. So when this first motion came on for hearing in July, we had 4 months of non-payment. The court continued that motion then to November. Now we had like 8 months of non-payment. And my client is working essentially almost full-time on this case because of the tremendous demands that were placed on her by Ms. Earle. If I can, I've collected some of the court quotes that refer to the tremendous volume of work my client was performing. There should be no doubt that my client was doing good work. Contrast the Doyle case, where there was concern about the quality of the work that was performed. My client was performing good work.
I'd like to ask a couple of questions on apart from the volume, about the nature of the relationships here. On one hand, it's easy to look at this and say it's just a private contract. But I'm not sure that encapsulates everything or encaptures everything that we need to look at, because the court is involved to some degree.
Absolutely.
It was a mediator and a stipulation, and the father's involved to a degree as well. So what, if anything, do you think that what implications, if any, do you think that has for our interpretation of the contract that appellant is saying generally doesn't permit or require payment of attorney's fees?
I think that's a good question, and I'll try to answer it this way. I think the contract is primary, but I think the court is almost like a third party to the contract to assure that whatever is transpiring in its guardianship matters are reasonable. And the court also stated, I'm going to determine what's reasonable. And how do you do that? Well, each of these emails, even if they're charged pursuant to the contract, it's a $10 item. If you had a client who was calling once a week, you'd have 12 of those or 16 of those by the end of the month. We had hundreds by the end of the month, and we had thousands during the period of 8 months. And it's made everything in this case so complicated to deal with thousands of emails. And how much time are we going to spend listing those in the invoice and identifying them with sufficient specificity in the invoice so that they can be identified by the by Ms. Earle? She frequently sent 5, 10, 15 emails in a day. Exhibit 7 in the second hearing is my client's what we call SharePoint or Outlook records, which record all of the emails, and you can and the time they came in, and you will see there the frequency of the emailing by Ms. Earle.
Can I ask you on the topic that we're talking about with opposing counsel, which is the first order? I understand, I mean, your position is that attorney's fees that were dedicated to compelling payment should be paid, but leaving that aside for a moment, did the first order award attorney's fees for counsel's time related to the motion to compel fees?
I think it did.
Okay. And do we know in what amount?
No.
Okay.
But let me suggest to you that the contract provided for expenses, quote, associated with any service provided. And I would submit to you that the services provided that were unpaid, that required legal action to try and get paid so that we could continue for the benefit of the ward, that those fees, even to collect fees to get paid so that we can continue to serve, are associated with a service provided.
Do you agree that all discovery-related charges that are listed on pages 8 through 10 of the blue brief, that anything that was related to discovery, that related only to the motion to compel payment of attorney's fees?
No. In particular, the deposition that we took of Ms. Earle.
It was a five-hour deposition, according to your records.
It took some time.
And it was like several hundred pages.
Yes.
Of which we apparently have four.
Yeah, the deposition is not in evidence, and the pages that you have, I think I agreed in with regard to the motion to strike that those pages could even be stricken because the information that was contained there was furnished in other ways to this court.
But so the deposition addressed topics other than payment of attorney's fees?
Oh, yes. We talked about her mental health issues, and we talked about some of the things that she was doing with the ward that were questionable. And
How about the interrogatories and document requests?
I think the interrogatories and document requests were solely related to fees.
Okay, thanks.
By both sides. If I may.
You mean they were charging time for responding to your requests? I'm not sure I understand the significance of that last comment, by both sides.
They submitted interrogatories that asked that we essentially produced to them all the emails, and we did that.
Okay, but still relating to the fees.
Well, they didn't relate it to anything in particular. They just wanted the emails.
Okay.
I
see. So they might have been looking for information beyond the scope of the fee dispute.
I can't comment on their state of mind.
Do you think that the involvement of the court and the mediator, the stipulation that comes from mediation, the balance that has to happen with the father, do you think that that creates any kind of obligation on the parties, separate and apart from what's in the contract?
I'm not understanding your question.
Well, for example, if in August the district court had said that we're going to alter the services that are required under the contract, under the service agreement. Instead of it being all seven for Earl and 4 for GCS. We're going to say all 7 for both. So the two parts of the contract include the compensation part and the services part. If the court alters the services part, is it your position that there's nothing GCS can do about it? They're obligated to remain in whatever form the court requires because it's not just a private contract.
I think GCS or Earl could have moved the court for to terminate the contract. The court commented on that neither party did. And the court also commented that the obligation of GCS and the rights of and the powers of GCS continued for until such time as GCS was removed. And they weren't removed. GCS was granted additional responsibilities on August 10th, and then the same additional responsibilities on February 1st. And I'd like to call your attention that the court specifically noted at the November hearing that it would consider the evidence in the November hearing also in the January hearing, which resulted in the February 1st order.
Do you have any additional questions? You will have 5 minutes on rebuttal. Time is up. Mr. Binman, do you want to take your 5 minutes of rebuttal?
And Your Honor, before I begin, it just occurred to me that if Mr. Wexler discusses issues raised by appellant in his rebuttal, I wouldn't have a chance to rebut that. And I'm not trying to make your life
all hard. Good things have to come to an end, counsel, and I think that's sure. The best we're going to do.
Okay. First of all, just one point of clarification on the attorney fee agreement, the $250 an hour. So that was a contract between GCS and its attorney. Ms. Earle was not a party to that agreement.
That's right, but in the agreement itself, it says customer will provide compensation for all charges, materials, and expenses associated. It seems like that is broad enough to incorporate the expenses of the guardian in hiring counsel. Why not?
Well, hiring counsel, perhaps, but not at a rate that is not included in the service agreement. The service agreement says $100 an hour for all services.
No, it says the service provider will charge $100 per hour.
Well, the point is...
Second paragraph of number 4, the service provider will charge $100 per hour, charging in 6-minute intervals. And the service provider is identified in the first paragraph of the document as GCS.
There's no other amount in the service agreement other than $100 an hour. So if GCS wanted to hire an attorney at $250 an hour, it had an obligation to tell Ms. Earle that under the American rule, payment of attorney fees needs to be explicit.
Well, again, you mentioned the American rule in your brief. I'm not sure that really applies to this because you have, as you've noted, two types of fees. Fees for services and fees incurred to collect those for that first type. I don't think the American rule applies to the first type. That's a fees for services issue. It's not litigation. The American rule is if you lose in a court case, the loser pays the winner's fees. So I don't think that applies to the first type. The second type it might apply to unless there's some exception there. But I think we're talking about the first type as we look at this, and I think you were trying to argue in your brief that the American rule had some impact on that first type. Put it differently, if there wasn't an attorney that was contracted with, but GCS contacted with somebody else who had an hourly fee that exceeded $100, are you saying that that is capped as well?
Well, I'm saying that GCS had an obligation to tell its client, the person who was paying it, what she was going to be paying. And the only amount that the service agreement states is $100 an hour. There's nothing in here that says that GCS might hire third parties at a higher rate than that. And even, you know, the expenses associated with any services provided, there has to be some sort of discussion about what that additional rate is going to be.
What if there had been a dispute at the outset about a third party? What could Ms. Earle have done? More mediation.
I'm sorry?
if there had been a dispute right at the outset about a third party's fees, that she thinks that that should be capped at 100, and she wants to raise that issue, isn't she compelled to mediate?
Well, I think there would have been a discussion at that point, but it, you know, it never came up, and Ms. Earle never saw an attorney invoice until GCS had filed its motion to compel. So that issue never came up. She never thought that was going to be an issue. I'd like to briefly talk about GCS's cross appeal. GCS basically wants it both ways. They want to say that Ms. Earle was so demanding that it forced them to incur all these fees, but because the volume was so high that they can't possibly prove that in court. Ms. Earle's conduct has nothing to do with why GCS wasn't awarded the fees for the emails. The reason that they didn't get awarded those fees is because they didn't prove it. And the district court spent 89 pages of findings explaining why that happened. So that's the reason that those fees were disallowed. GCS had its day in court to prove the amount it was entitled to, and it didn't do it. And then finally, in my remaining time, I want to talk about the point one billing that you discussed with Mr. Wexler. My understanding of the 10-minute increment rule is you start your timer, and if at the end of the day you're at 57 minutes, you can round up to an hour. It doesn't mean that every single task you do, you can round up to a tenth of an hour. And I think that's the way that it's always been interpreted. I haven't seen anything to the contrary.
In other words, if a person, what you're suggesting and arguing is if the lawyer gets an email and it takes 1 minute, and then later in the day gets another email for 1 minute, you're still at the first one-tenth of an hour.
Right, you're still
at 2 minutes. Until you get to 6 minutes.
That's right. And then at the end of the day, I suppose if that's all you do, you could round up to 6 minutes.
Of course, there'd be another tenth of an hour in keeping track of such things.
Well, I'll leave that for the Supreme Court on an ethics violation someday. Right.
You have additional questions?
If it's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
I had asked Mr. Wexler a similar question, but do you think the nature of the court's involvement or the stipulation, the balance that the court and the mediator had to draw with respect to the father, do you think that creates any additional obligation apart from what's in the contract? In other words, if the compensation terms are altered or the service terms are altered, both sides are stuck with that because there is this involvement of the court. There's some requirement from the court.
There's involvement from the court, but nothing prevented GCS from going to the court and saying, we're not getting paid. We would like to be removed from this case, and then all fees would have stopped anyway. So even though there is that involvement, it's still within GCS's power to do something about it. And given the unique change in circumstances after August 10, 2018, there's no longer the contract as the parties understood it no longer existed. So I would request that the court reverse the district court with regard to the attorney fee and post-suspension fee issues and affirm in all other respects. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Wexler, you have 5 minutes if you wish to use that time.
This case needs a remand for something. It needs a remand to adequately advise the parties in advance what the court's test is going to be to determine what are reasonable charges. If the effort that's going to be required to itemize 7,000 pages of emails for $10 each is going to be the test, we'll do that. But it seems to me that there ought to be a different way to do it. No one has suggested a different way to do it, but I'm going to suggest one to you, which I would not prefer, but apparently it's what the district court would have preferred, and that is that we identify every email for which we charge. Okay, we'll do that, because the pages are numbered 1 through 7,000. We've got them.
But they're not in our record now.
They're not in your record. I had a flash drive that I could have put into evidence, and I chose not to do that. Maybe that was the wrong choice, but that was on our exhibit list.
You actually had one of the charges in the billing was putting it on the flash drive, right? Didn't I notice that?
We provided flash drives to Consul.
Oh, I see. You just didn't offer it.
And we had it on our list.
Understood.
And in a moment of stupidity, perhaps, I chose not to put it into evidence. I thought, having been a judge, I wouldn't want this in my record. I don't want to look at 7,000 pages of emails. But we could do that. We could take each page number that we charged for and explain how much time we put in on it. Maybe we should also approach it entirely differently. Maybe we should say, like my client said and like the court noted, this has been almost a full-time job for me for months. Take 6 hours a day for 20 days a month and say that's the amount of time that we should be charging for. That comes to more, by the way, but that's another alternative. But this case is very different from Doyle in that respect, because my client was providing great service. And the court noted that in a variety of ways.
Yes, the district court here did not say that there were any services that were inadequately provided or poorly provided and then disallowed it.
No, in fact, the court said GCS fulfilled its statutory obligations and provided services to ensure the ward's health, safety, and well-being.
Yeah, I don't think appellants have argued anything to the contrary.
The court also said this has been a very time-consuming guardianship, much more so than any I've seen in my time in this division. GCS fulfilled its statutory obligations and provided services to ensure the ward's health, safety, and well-being. Ms. Earle sent hundreds of emails to GCS and other parties. Ms. Earle's emails are accusatory and demanding in nature and create extra work for the guardian. The guardian has been very involved in providing services for the ward. And there are more. My client and I have been doing what we can to try to get this, to try to get the court to award some reasonable compensation. Zero, we should all be able to agree, is not reasonable compensation. The court had an obligation to determine reasonable compensation, and that's why this case is different than a normal party versus party litigation, because the court has a function here too. And the court's function could have included a remand or a reopening of the record to address the court's concerns about what's reasonable compensation. I haven't gotten to the attorney's fees, but I'd like to note that Ms. Earle's attorney did not dispute the hourly rate. He didn't dispute the number of hours billed. He admitted that the attorney services were necessary, reasonably necessary, to get compensation for a guardian. A guardian's continued service is important for the ward's welfare, and that's noted in Minnesota statute. I forget what the citation is, 309, is it 525-309? The court notes it in its findings that that determines priority of appointment as a guardian, and the first priority is to the current guardian. Continuity of service of the guardian is important, and we were advocating for the continuity of our guardian service. And I'm out of time. We never have enough time.
Any questions? Looks like the panel has no additional questions. We thank both of counsel for your briefing and argument. The matter is submitted, and we'll issue our decision within 90 days. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
And that is the end of our oral calendar, with some fits and starts along the way.
Nice to see you again.